or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Organizations. Most of us work for one, whether a company, nonprofit, or government agency. And outside of work, we're part of organizations from churches to Little League to activist groups. So often, organizations are frustrating. The bureaucracy, the inefficiency, the feeling, I could do it better if I ran it. And yet organizations do what individuals just can't seem to do. They can create a refrigerator. They can create a car that's affordable to the masses, an apartment, an aspirin. I mean, go try to bake an aspirin by yourself. It is quite amazing that they do that at a, you know, one. I was in Home Depot this morning, and there was a refrigerator for $4.99, brand new. Shipping that would seem to cost $4.99. Anyway, I also think about what other organizations do. They can run a hospital. They can run a service club like Rotary, Kiwanis, Lions, whatever. They run a police force. They run a school. The organization. Why is it so necessary and yet so infuriating? My guests are the co-authors of a new book called The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office. Ray Fissman directs the Social Enterprise Program at Columbia Business School. Ray, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Tim Sullivan's the editorial director of Harvard Business Review Press. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Well, why don't we start by, you're telling the story of Scott Urban. This is the guy who created wooden eyeglass frames. Tell us about that.
So I'll start off. This is Ray. I must confess to being an avid consumer of Scott Urban's products. I met him at a craft fair some years ago where he was, I guess you could say, engaged in the marketing of his products. Since it is a one-person organization, he does everything. Back then, I actually purchased what was the second pair of glasses he sold, and they were pretty rudimentary craft at that point, but I now have another couple of pairs, and he's really come a long way. These are glasses that sell for $1,000 a piece, and that's without the lenses themselves. And they are, in my view, a work of art. And it's an art that Scott takes very seriously. You know, I should add that if $1,000 sounds like a lot, rarely does a day pass that I don't have some beautiful young woman or pretty much anyone ask me on the street where I got those fantastic glasses. It's hard to put a price on that. Now, Scott, at the same time, feels very frustrated with his existence at times because in addition to making the glasses, there are all of these headaches that he has to take care of, from marketing to keeping track of expenses and revenues and the timing of his production, that in a larger organization, the artisan simply outsources to the, that stuff is taken care of by the marketing department, by the accounting department, and so on. So on the one hand, he lives in the pristine simplicity of his one-person organization. At the same time, he loses out on all of the benefits that come with the specialization that we can have in a larger company. And I think the last thing I would say about Scott is, you know, he's barely scraping by. He could go work for a large faceless organization tomorrow doing carpentry for them, and I'm sure he would at minimum double his salary. But, you know, when you're doing everything by hand, you can't do more than maybe a few dozen pairs of spectacles per year.
Yeah. You know, I myself am a one-person atavistic operation. I'm a career counselor, and frankly, I've been asked for decades, why have I not expanded creating NEMCO-certified career counselors and open offices throughout the region, throughout the regions, etc. And I just love the simplicity of my life. And yes, I keep my accounting system. I don't even have an accountant. I just put my receipts in a box. I only have one, you know, I only have one or two income sources, and so there's no big bookkeeping required. You know, I provide a service. I don't have a manufacturing plant. And the joys of the control, the quality control, I tried expanding and hiring a couple of other people, and there was invariably, no matter how carefully I hired, there was some discontent. So lest we too quickly dismiss the one-person operation, at least I needed to put a word in for that form of life, as long as you've priced yourself enough so that you can at least make a middle-class living. Anything you wanted to add or subtract to that?
Yeah, I would say that you may, in fact, have some managerial aptitude such that you don't need someone to manage, whereas Scott, I think, would proudly say that he's an artist, an artisan, and this other stuff, the management of the organization, is not something that he's interested in or particularly good at. So absolutely, if you're a one-person operation, you have to have some ability in handling these other parts of what are inevitable complications in even a one-person organization.
And what I would argue is you can make them really simple by really, really being assiduous and not overcomplicating your life. Like I said, with accounting systems, not needing, if you don't have any payroll, if you keep your costs to a minimum so you don't have this huge nut that you have to deal with. I'm not saying it's the answer, but let's move on beyond that.
Well, I would say that you just maybe expressed why you have some managerial aptitude.
Perhaps.
Working out these systems.
Perhaps. Okay, so let's tell another story, and maybe we should turn to you, to Tim, to tell this one. Your book, which is, by the way, The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office, or Seeming Logic, here's a story of an American Airlines employee who quite brilliantly proposed a redo for the company website. You want to tell us about that, Tim?
Yeah, it's actually a guy. The original guy was not an American Airlines employee. He just was a web designer, and he was trying to buy a ticket from American Airlines and couldn't do it. You know, if you've ever gone to a really complicated website, you've got a section of it devoted to advertising, and then there's specials for returning customers. And he just wanted to, like, pick his flight and pay a price and go. And from his perspective, this was a disaster of a website. So he sits down, and he designs, like, five different versions. His name's Dustin Curtis. And he says, look, I just took an hour, American Airlines, and I made you an awesome website. Why can't you guys do it? Because you've got thousands of designers, and you're in a huge organization. Mm-hmm. He doesn't expect to get a response. And then it turns out a guy from the user design experience team at American Airlines writes to him, and he says, you're absolutely right. Your website is a lot better than ours. We've been working on a redesign for 3 years. And I'm confident we can get it right. You know, we're going to keep on keeping on. But you have to understand that there are all these trade-offs working for a big organization, and there are lots of different people who feel like they own this. But we're going to get it right, and thanks so much for paying attention. The upshot of the story is that American Airlines sees the exchange. They actually track down their employee's email, you know, using their internal database, and they find him, and they fire him.
Why would they fire him?
Well, their claim was that he was giving up proprietary information about website design and business plans. From the outside, it seems kind of clear that they fired him for actually talking about how they make the sausage, and they were upset about that.
Why should they be upset about that? Is that really that proprietary? I mean, you're admitting
oh,
that
no,
there are weaknesses in the company. Why would that be a, you know, that really feeds into the public perception of the corporation as almost Nazi-like in its enforcement. Is that I am not a corporate employee myself. Is that a legitimate assertion, a generalizable assertion?
I wouldn't go straight to the Nazis. There may be some intermediate steps in between there. But I think it heightens kind of the ill feelings that we absolutely have towards big organizations. Like, but at the same time, the other side of this is that American Airlines or lots of other big organizations do feel like they have lots of internal systems and viewpoints that they have to balance. Instead of thinking about, like, what the customer needs, they're thinking about what the organization needs. And I think that's endemic to a lot of big organizations.
Lest we be guilty of one-sided presentation of, you know, bashing these organizations, let's look at the other side. It's a provocative quote in your book in which you say that the a hospital administrator is more likely to save your life than the heart surgeon. The video game supervisor is more important to creating a great piece of software than the team of designers. Explain that.
So there are a couple of things here. One is I think it's important to note that when you go under the knife for a heart surgery, you absolutely want a skilled cardiac surgeon to do the job. That is, the manager can't do it on his own. At the same time, there's a whole organizational apparatus that will save your life after, before and after the actual surgery takes place. There are systems, in fact, that even need to be in place while the surgery is going on. Checklists, ensuring that the right people are there to support the surgeon, the right materials. So the organizational apparatus is at least as important as the person holding the scalpel, at least in theory. And in practice, you know, the facts bear out this point of view. The reference to the video game supervisor being at least as important, and in fact far, far more important, as it turns out, than the designer, comes from a study done by a Wharton professor who looked at which individuals contributed most to the success, both measured by popularity as well as revenues of video games. And the way he does this, because video games are designed based on a team production model, you have supervisors, project managers, who are paired up with a range of product designers, and then they split apart and recombine in different permutations. So the way to think about it is, if you follow a supervisor from game to game to game, and every time that supervisor is managing the game production process, that game does really, really well or really, really poorly, then you know that you can associate the one who does really, really well all the time with the good outcome, and the one who always produces duds is probably not an effective manager. And it turns out that in terms of the outcomes of video game production, success tends to move much more with the project manager, the supervisor, than the head designer. So the manager matters much more, at least as much, in fact, much, much more in this case, than the maker. Similarly, you find that well-managed hospitals tend to generate much, much better patient outcomes.
I find myself loving hearing this, because I know how many millions of managers feel like, you know, unimportant middle cogs in a very large wheel, and I suspect there's a few of them, more than a few listening to the show, who are going to take a sigh of relief and say, yes, I'm not irrelevant. Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Ray Fistman and Tim Sullivan. They're the authors of a brand new book, which I love. I tend to normally, when I have a book to read for the show, I tend to read a couple of chapters. I actually read it cover to cover. Why? And I will really admit it's for a shallow reason. You know, it's yes, the ideas are good and contrarian in many ways, which I love. I'm always constitutionally contrarian, but it's filled with fun anecdotes. It's well written. The guy, one of the authors, Tim Sullivan, is the editor of Harvard Business Review Press. So, you know, if anybody was going to write a good book, and it's published by 12, my very favorite publishing company. They're really, you know, these were guys who quit the really big mega publishing companies to start their own, and they only publish 12 books a year. So I do commend the book, The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office, to you. You know, I always laugh at corporate speak. And corporate speak usually comes out of either the marketing communications department or the public relations department or the human resources department. But they're always talking about crap like, you know, our most important product is our people and planet. And you know, it's all about the, you know, I watch the Chevron commercials and you almost think we're talking Mother Teresa is the underlying organization. There is rather a large gap between those proclamations and most folks' experiences in the cubicle. Why is there? I mean, everybody agrees with those ideals. We want to, you know, have a balance of all of the factors and think cosmically. And yet in the real world, we have pettiness and shallowness. Is it simply a matter that when you put people together, there's going to be pettiness and shallowness? Or is there something dysfunctional about this organization, whether it be a nonprofit or a company, that we need to understand?
I think there are a couple things going on. First, thank you so much for saying nice things about the book. I appreciate it.
Absolutely true stuff.
I think there are a couple of things. One, I think human resources has shifted to become a compliance department rather than a talent management department. So they are all about kind of fulfilling the monitoring function that the organization needs. You know, they're there to make sure that I's get dotted and T's get crossed and that we are following legal rules and following best practice.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, they start talking like a corporate being instead of individual humans because they're not speaking for themselves. They're speaking for the organization. But that's kind of natural. It's kind of built into the way organizations, kind of the tensions in organizations in the first place. You know, organizations do go out of their way to hire the right people for the job. They want to hire people who are intrinsically motivated, who just want to do the job because they love it.
Right.
And at the same time, they've got to assure that everybody's doing what they're supposed to. Because obviously there are pieces of every job that people don't actually like doing. You know, there are lots of Friday afternoons I would rather put my head on my desk rather than editing that last chapter. And in a lot of ways, those compliance monitoring functions are absolutely necessary. Nobody really wants to do them, and so you get this department in human resources or others who end up kind of fulfilling that role and cease sounding human.
Ray, you know, this brings me to what is my core. Really, I found myself last night in the middle of the night. I got up, and I was thinking about this issue, the following thing I'm going to ask you about. You know, most people who I know, and maybe it's because I live in this bubble of certain kinds of folks, are so intrinsically motivated that there is a, if in there, when they work in an organization, there is a net negative effect of the monitoring function. In other words, the supervisor, accounting requirements, reports, all of that stuff to monitor your time is not only not positive and not necessary, but it creates a gotcha policing culture that actually decreases intrinsic motivation. Why do not more companies simply, or and nonprofits and government agencies, take the time necessary to find really, you know, to find good intrinsically motivated people and then recognize that, because everything is trade-offs, that there is a greater good that will accrue to the individuals and to the organization by having absolutely minimal monitoring and instead maximum self-efficacy, like as Google, which allows their employees so much free time to do stuff?
Well, I think that that is a wonderful aspiration. I think it is important. The way I often respond to this is by, you know, observing that employee suggestion boxes are crammed full with many truly awful ideas. They're not awful from the perspective of the person who stuffed them into the suggestion box, and they may even be great for his little corner of the company. But the reason why you need the monitoring and the oversight and the product review cycles and the idea review cycles is because you need to prevent people from implementing well-meaning but potentially catastrophic ideas, and that does in fact mean that a lot less gets done, a lot less of the good stuff gets done, but that's the cost of ensuring that some of the bad stuff doesn't happen as well. A story that we like to tell is about...
Before you do that, yeah. I want to respond to that. Yep. You know, there is a big difference between having new ideas that would change the direction of an organization vetted and the monitoring of the day-to-day functioning, you know, sales reports and marketing, you know, constant monitoring. Mm-hmm. I think there's a big difference there. I am more than willing to agree that something that's going to reallocate significant resources from an organization needs to be vetted by the best and brightest in the organization. But there's a grand canyon of difference between that and the monitoring function that represents 90% of the monitoring that goes on. Do you agree with that or disagree?
Yep. So let me respond briefly in a couple of ways. First of all, it depends absolutely on what job needs to get done. An interesting example of this is if you take Netflix, the people at the high, like the computer engineers at Netflix, are akin to the Google anecdote you just gave. They are, in fact, given a lot of freedom to innovate and do creative things. But the people who are stuffing DVDs into envelopes absolutely have a camera above them and absolutely have a quota of envelopes that they have to stuff because, you know, mainly they just need to work like cogs in a wheel. Is unfortunate reality. So it depends on what the job is that needs to get done. The second thing is everyone has aspects of his or her job that are less pleasant than others.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the monitoring is to make sure some of the less desirable aspects of what every job entails get done as well. I certainly have things I would rather not do, meetings I'd rather not show up for at Columbia University. And some of the rules and some of the attendance taking is to make sure that I do those things as well.
So in other words, let's say, let's look at Columbia University Business School. And let's say I waved a magic wand and we eliminated any kind of external accountability. There is no attendance taking. There's no paperwork. There's no nothing. Mm-hmm. Look at the net. We agree there'll probably be some decrement in the amount of productivity from those people who need that monitoring. But there'll also be the increased sense of respect and trust for the individual. Do you think that net-net, that Columbia Business School would be a would create more good for its for those employees, for its customers, for the larger society, with or without those rules?
Absolutely, the organization would implode fairly quickly.
Interesting.
I've talked to the head of accounts payable about some of the completely outrageous claims that people used to try to put in before we got the Kafkaesque, somewhat oppressive travel and expense system we currently have in place. And, you know, I have a little more respect for the logic of the world of Kafka than I did before discussing it with her.
Very interesting. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guests are Ray Fishman and Tim Sullivan, the authors of an excellent book, The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office. I want to turn to CEOs. You know, if it's anything that the Bay Area is almost in unanimous agreement about, is that CEOs are pigs making far too much money than they deserve. And they, you know, the 99ers and the occupiers and, you know, probably 95% of the Bay Area would believe that CEOs are overpaid. Your book discusses that issue. Would you care to comment on the validity of that assertion? Why don't you take this one?
Yeah. We are not. We don't want to come across as apologists for CEO pay, but what we're suggesting is you have to understand the system of how we got here and what the logic is before you can decide how they ought to be paid, how CEOs, what the mechanism ought to be, and what you're going to do about the gap if you're going to do something about it, and whether they in fact paid too much. So the first place to start maybe is to think about the value that they can add. If you have a really good CEO who is, you know, actually absorbing all of that information from reports we don't like to give and is sitting in lots of meetings to get down to the root problem of what's going on in the organization and the direction it should take. If you really have the best person running your organization at the head of the organization, there's a strong argument to be made that if they incrementally change things slightly for the better, and you have a $1 billion organization, then they are worth many millions of dollars in pay because the net effect of their good decision-making is such that across the organization, things are going to be dramatically better.
Of course. But now, of course, there are a couple of factors that are core assumptions in there. Number one is that he or she is that huge value-added person. And in fact, empirically, we see that even those who have driven their company into huge net losses also get huge pay. The example I love to give is a quote from your book. You wrote, Merrill Lynch's Stan O'Neill left Merrill Lynch in 2007 amid accusations of creating a culture of reckless risk-taking and pushing Merrill to build its business of repackaging and reselling subprime loans. He was at the core of the subprime loan crisis. He left with a package worth over $160 million. Is that defensible?
That is a whole lot of money. So it's hard to defend it after the fact, but I don't think anybody would have guessed before the fact that O'Neill was actually going to be the one to bring things down. Because when you're picking your CEO, if you're a board, of course you think you've got the best guy, right, or best woman. Mm-hmm. That it's predicated at least partly on the fact that boards and other people picking chief executive are confident that they are really doing due diligence and getting the very best person. And then they're composing a system based on that idea. So.
Can I jump in with one follow-up comment? I don't think we're trying to say anywhere here that every organization is somehow the best that it could possibly be, subject to the many constraints that exist. Of course, you can make organizations better, and of course, there are horrible managers and horrible organizations. And by the same token, we don't mean to suggest that every CEO hiring decision was enlightened and entirely well-meaning. So I wasn't in the boardroom when Stan O'Neill was hired. We certainly know after the fact that it was disastrous. I think it's very useful and often very instructive to go back to the period in time when these hiring decisions were made and reading about what was said, you know, when it was initially announced. And often you get a very different perspective on what the public sees as good and bad decisions. Sometimes bad decisions are, in fact, recognized at the time as really bad ideas.
What do you explain that? What if we read the press release about O'Neill's hiring, what would we have discovered?
Well, you might have discovered that he had a pretty decent track record to that point as a leader and manager. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very often people who, it can also be some element of people who perform extremely well as divisional managers somehow don't have what it takes to be CEO, or somehow someone parachuting in from the outside doesn't quite have the institutional knowledge to turn a company around or keep it going in the right direction.
Peter,
this is a huge and complicated issue.
Yeah, I want to ask a convoluted question, but maybe very core to this. Has there been research that looks at the probabilities of, you know, of guessing right? There are so many factors that lead to a CEO's success or failure. Even the august, you know, people like Steve Jobs had two mammoth failures in the Lisa and Newton. Coke's Roberto Goizueta is revered, yet he was responsible for the new Coke debacle. And so much is a matter of being at the right point in history and guessing right. I'd be guilty of overgeneralizing by criticizing, you know, picking out Stan O'Neill as one guy. But is there good evidence overall as to whether paying a CEO $3 million, $5 million, $10 million a year is there enough predictive validity to justify doing that?
Well, I think that's something that's really hard to pick apart because of all the noise that you're describing.
Right.
So that's to some degree why we put our faith in the board of directors, that they have the inside view on what's actually going on in the company, and they can see which is the CEO's doing and which is just bad luck. So we allow them to make the decision of whether to keep the guy on or fire him and who to hire in the first place. There's at least some indication that lots of CEOs are seen as core to the company's success in the reaction that the stock market has to news about their departure through unexpected circumstances, Steve Jobs being a case in point. Every time he had the sniffles, Apple's share price took a nosedive. Well, so obviously I'm picking an extreme example.
Right.
But it does generalize to some degree. There are certainly many examples throughout history of CEOs being in plane crashes and the stock price dropping by, you know, 3-4 percentage points. If that's the effect that a CEO has on the company's value, then maybe he is worth a few million a year.
I want to tackle this from one other very kind of a very lofty angle, which is this. Let's pretend that I am a factory worker sweating in a manufacturing plant, and I'm making $50,000 a year. And part of why I'm there is the accident of my birth, whom I was born to, where I was raised, my intellectual and environmentally imposed limitations, and some other man or woman who was more fortunate in how he or she was endowed, if you will, is now making 109 times as much as I am as a CEO. If I am that $50,000 worker and I say, you were born literally or metaphorically with a silver spoon, a genetic and environmental silver spoon in your mouth, how dare you make me live and worry about whether I can afford toilet paper or tomatoes this month while you have three mansions and four yachts? What would you say to that worker?
I would say that is absolutely why we should have a top marginal tax rate of 90%. I have no problem with that. This is a distinction between what makes the company most successful, which may be paying its CEO a lot, and what we think we can stomach as a society, which is maybe less inequality than that gives us. So I have absolutely no problem with taking from the outrageously wealthy CEO and redistributing that money to workers at his own company and elsewhere.
Controversial position. Tim, I'd like your opinion on that issue.
I think it's also a case that if you look at how the margin between a line worker and a CEO has changed over the past 30 years, it's gone from I don't remember the exact multiple if you go back 30 years, but now I think CEOs make around 130 times more than an average worker within their company. The system in there is very much what you describe, where you have, and it's a systemic problem. It's not because they're people who are deliberately going out to do bad things. Both through benchmarking CEOs' pay against other CEOs in similar situations, about the competition for the right CEO for the job, about the function of boards, that has really helped to drive up CEOs' pay in a way that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Let me take the opposite point of view, because it's always fun to look at both sides. So what if I said that, you know, it's the incentive issue. If incentives matter at all, if Skinner was at all right that we respond to positive incentives, if we cap, if we taxed the CEO pay at 90%, might not, and most people who are CEO-level folks, they've got enough money that they can retire well. They say, screw it. I would rather go and be an, you know, I'll be an actor. I'll write my novel. I'll do my whatever. And might we not, therefore, if we tax CEO pay at 90%, might we not lose the best and brightest, the people who will commandeer the drug company that's going to create the cure for cancer and so on?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, that's possible. I think to some degree, the paychecks are a way of keeping score once the figures get that large. As you say, it's less of, you know, you can afford to do whatever you want in terms of material possessions once the numbers get that large. This is going beyond the world of organizations,
right,
to the world of public finance and tax policy. My rough sense, though admittedly a liberal-leaning sense of this, is that there's relatively little evidence that higher marginal tax rates crowd out effort, which is what you're suggesting.
Interesting. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm having fun. I hope you guys are, too, my guests and my listeners. They are the authors of a new book, which I love, called The Org, because it's quite contrarian in many ways, and contrarian and smart. There's a lot of contrarian stupidity, but this is contrarian and smart. The subtitle is The Underlying Logic of the Office, Ray Fishman and Tim Sullivan. Let's give the callers, my listeners, a chance that they... we can't do that. Okay, never mind. Okay, so, you know, logic would suggest that the best of worker bees get promoted to boss. And yet we constantly hear complaints in the media and from people about bosses, but we rarely hear complaints about workers. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think if you put a bunch of managers together, you might hear some of those complaints.
I mean publicly. I mean the media and say, we're not allowed to criticize the worker. Why?
I'm not sure why we're not allowed to criticize workers per se. I think there's probably a lot of social pressure, simple social pressure against doing it, because most of the people who would be doing the criticism in public tend to be of an elite status rather than workers themselves. But it's kind of it's self-evident that, you know, if you do start promoting people who were great workers to be managers, and you can become subject to the Peter principle, where you know, everybody rises to the level of their own incompetence, and you end up with managers who are making radically more public mistakes. Right? If a worker makes a mistake, who's going to hear about it? Not that many people.
Good point.
A manager makes a mistake, boy, there are a whole lot of people paying attention. And you know, if you go up to the you go up the corporate ladder farther and farther, there are more and more people paying attention the higher you go up. You know, the higher you climb, the more the monkey shows its tail, sort of thing.
You know, dear listeners, by the way, there's a phrase I love to use in this regard called, up is not the only way. I really think the wise person recognizes where he or she is most wisely situated. The American way is, you know, we climb the ladder, even though the ladder has been, in many ways, has been sawed off in many areas. It's still, there is this belief that we are a more worthy human being if we are a director than a manager, and certainly a manager over an individual contributor. And yet, really, that in some ways, that's crazy. You know, it really does require a certain amount of internal introspection about where are you most likely to contribute most, feel best about your work, and are you one of those people who, unlike CEOs, crave work-life balance? Because let me tell you, I'm a career counselor. I don't know if you guys know this. Most of my clients are C-level people, or a lot of my clients are C-level people. They don't have work-life balance at all. Men or women, they love work. They would much rather spend another, you know, hour or two reading those spreadsheets or a book or speaking to their Asian folks than playing Monopoly with their kids, you know, even though that's sacrilegious to the mainstream. So up is not the only way. Do you have anything you guys want to add to that or no?
So I wrote a short blog piece on the Wall Street Journal site titled Confessions of a Crummy Manager. And let me tell you, it was quite cathartic to put out in the public domain how much happier I was not managing things. Just to live my quasi-hermit-like life, writing books, doing academic work, and letting someone else handle the meetings.
Okay, you mentioned meetings. That's perfect. Anything people hate about organizations or the modal criticism of corporations, that is the most frequent one, is meetings. So many people hate it. Why so many meetings, and should there be fewer?
Yeah, there are a lot of really bad meetings. So I think the criticism is entirely warranted. I have sat through lots of them. Mm-hmm. I have led some of them. They can be really bad. But it's hard to distinguish sometimes from kind of a worker's perspective, what's a useless meeting and what's a useful meeting, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this big gray area about, why are you interrupting my work? You know, I was sitting and doing something, some three-hour-long task, and then this Outlook notification pops up on me in my email and tells me I have to go to a meeting that, from my point of view, seems totally pointless.
Right.
But from the organization's point of view, meetings are a really important way to get soft information, you know, information you can't write down in a spreadsheet, information that you can't put in an email, to get soft information up the kind of chain of command so that people who are making decisions actually have the best information available. And at the same time, so you get soft information going up, it's really hard sometimes for a CEO or a manager or any other executive to transmit their message in really clear, high fidelity. And meetings are one way you can do that. You know, if your CEO sits you down and tells you what you're supposed to do and asks you probing questions, there's a lot of information conveyed in that exchange.
That's
one thing, is just kind of pure information going back and forth.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of your book, where you described, in your attempt to try to provide at least some balm for folks who are critical of CEO pay, CEOs or you know any kind of leader is at their best in earning their money in meetings by being very subtle in picking up those soft cues. Everybody who comes into a meeting in a corporation or when they testify before Congress is always trying to give a dog and pony show.
Yep.
And the really good CEO or whatever teases out the truth of what's really going on. And also, as you say, it's very subtle to give messages. Can you give us a specific example of what a good person who runs a meeting does to unearth the truth or to disseminate a message in a way that couldn't be done in a written directive?
Yeah, there's a great example of one of Ray's friends, Drew Curtis, who runs a website, basically, and everybody works from home or from a coffee shop or whatever. And he says they have to get together every once in a while, because they all have to sit down and look each other in the eye and figure out that they're all actually on the same team. And they can't do that over email because it's such a blunt instrument. So it's only by sitting down in the room together and looking each other in the eye that, you know, you can forget all those petty things that you're thinking about when you're obsessing about your job by yourself in your living room, and realizing that everybody else you work with is entirely human.
Nice concept. Email is a blunt instrument. Yeah, go ahead.
Puts it a bit more forcefully in that unless they meet with some frequency, everyone starts to get paranoid.
Interesting. Okay. Let's kind of bring things to a conclusion here. Let's talk about the new corporation. You were just mentioning this notion that ever more workplaces are virtual, where, you know, I'm in my underwear in my home office and somebody else is at Starbucks and somebody else is trying to find Nirvana on a mountaintop. What do you see as, you know, play at nobody? Everybody who tries to live by the crystal ball ends up eating broken glass. But let's, you know, in the short to medium term, what do you think are going to be the logical outcomes of this move to ever more virtualization of the office, of the org?
So absolutely, people are telecommuting a lot more now than they were a decade ago.
Right.
And that surely will continue. But it's important to recognize the sorts of things that are going to be driving this trend. It will, in fact, be a lot of the stuff that's relatively easily monitored, stuff like customer and managing, handling customer service calls, doing telemarketing, where there's someone back at the company who can see how productive you are minute to minute, then I don't have to watch over you.
Yeah.
And it's the sort of stuff where the face-to-face meetings are less important, where I can just send you a set of written directives. And that describes some of the world and some of what we do at work, but not a huge amount of it. And that's one reason why companies are, in fact, growing larger rather than shrinking. The other piece of this that people talk a lot about is the ability to find partners to run things through market-based transactions rather than within an organization via the internet. So there are companies like Odesk, for example,
right,
where I can put up online, I need someone to transcribe these five pages of PDF into Word, and I'll pay $85 for it, which is, by the way, something that I put up on Odesk, or a friend, someone I work with put up on Odesk a week and a half ago. And it is fantastic when you have this easily contractable task to have someone take care of rather than rummaging around within your organization for perhaps not quite the right person to do it. We did, in fact, pay $85 for a perfect transcription that would otherwise have caused my assistant immense headaches and distracted her from other things for, I suspect, days.
Exactly, and me too. Even as a solo operator, my latest book, I decided to get the cover designed through something called 99 Designs, where, you know, you put out your specifications for what you're looking for in a cover, and I got literally 120 bids, people for $200 to design the cover, and so I spent $200 to get 100 people's input, and I picked the best ones, and it was a joy and a pleasure.
Let me temper this enthusiasm just with the observation that many of these transactions go awry. Like Kickstarter has, various people have had good experiences with Kickstarter in the sort of peer-to-peer funding world. And many people have had decidedly less satisfactory experiences.
I agree. And that there is, you know, there's always the creative destruction of capitalism. I really believe that Kickstarter and Indiegogo are going to fade, because right now there's, for example, a new website called angellist.com, which lists only accredited investors who are, you know, are not going to pull their money or not going to play games. It's very, very good. So I encourage you to consider angellist.com. You know, one of the things that I can't let you go because these things just keep popping in my head. One of the things I don't understand, maybe because I'm just this insensitive white male who's also hermetic by nature, is why has not Skype and GoToMeeting and video conferencing replaced the in-person meeting? People, it's such a pain in the ass to fly, you know, to a regional meeting or a national meeting. It's so expensive. Why has virtualization, both in meetings and in online education, why are there still these trainings where everybody flies into corporate headquarters for trainings? What am I not getting?
So I think there are a couple of things. One, I think there'll just be more of that. I think companies are just starting to realize the value of or take advantage, really, of the value of video conferencing and Skype and lots of other communication media. And they'll continue to do that, and I think that will only increase the value of in-person meetings.
How do you mean?
So if you're meeting less in person, the fact that when somebody shows up, that's actually going to be a marker of something really important. I also think that they're probably kind of positive effects from being together that you don't realize. So we think about this, you know, I go to these meetings where people get together like once every 6 months or once every year, and there's so much other business done there other than just what we're allegedly there to do.
Good point.
You know, you're renewing relationships, you're hanging out, you're talking about other stuff, you come up with ideas, you know, when you're having a drink after the sessions, those sorts of things. And that does have a real positive effect for the organization that oftentimes goes unrecognized.
I got one other question I've got to ask, and maybe and maybe Tim, you'd be a good one to tackle this. You know, here in the Bay Area, we are fond of getting rid of leaders. The ultimate manifestation of a reduced hierarchy, a shrunk district, you know, what they call disintermediation, is the leaderless organization. No top level, no middle level. You know, the Occupy movement was an example of a leaderless organization. Alas, within months, it dwindled from massive to almost nothing. Is there a track record for leaderless organizations that gives us any more hope than that, or do we really need leaders?
Yeah, I think we work with a lot of people who want leaders. You know, when we talk about recognizing that you're satisfied with your position within an organization, part of that is that there are people who don't want to have to make decisions, who just want to know, this is what my job is and this is what I'm going to do. Tell me where I'm supposed to show up and I'll do the job, but I don't want to have to decide where that's going to be. And I think that's fine. I think one of the problems with leaderless organizations and with the structure of organization, too, is how do they make decisions? Who's going to decide what direction you're pointing in? And can you make sure that you're getting feedback in a timely way so that you're able to make those decisions? It's one thing if everybody knows what you're supposed to be doing. Like Al-Qaeda was touted as this organization of the future for a while. You know, it was cellular. People were dedicated, so dedicated they would kill other people. They'd blow themselves up. And yet, it was hard for them to turn on a dime and to react super quickly in an organized, concerted way. And I think that was part of the organized problem as well, is when everybody had to have a say,
consensus,
when there was total consensus, it's really hard to move forward in a way that's going to be reacting quickly to external stimuli.
That makes sense. I've experienced that as well. Let's bring this to conclusion by giving you, because this is so much fun, I'd like to give each of you the ultimate softball question. If there was one other thing that you would like to share with our listeners about organizations that's not obvious and yet important that we haven't yet discussed, what would you want to share? Would you ever want to go first? Go first.
I think that, so this is Tim, that yep. I think people oftentimes think that that they're so constrained in their organization that everything's better, you know, grass is always greener. And just to take a step back and try to understand from the organization's perspective why you have to fill out that P&E report, kind of what the cost to the organization is. And maybe a good example of that is someplace like McDonald's. Right, McDonald's has done incredibly well at innovating, and yet they are incredibly controlling of all their franchisees. They would never let their franchises just start kind of going willy-nilly in whatever direction they wanted to.
Making fries the way they want to.
Yeah, or even like, we're going to have a shrimp offering. Well, if they started offering shrimp, pretty soon there would be no shrimp left in the ocean, right, simply because of the scale of the operation. And yet they're incredibly successful, and they've done a really great job of motivating their employees so that people tend to be pretty happy there compared to other organizations of the same kind.
Makes sense. Ray Fisman, what's your parting shot?
I think my parting shot would be essentially the organizational equivalent of the Serenity Prayer, which is that people have to understand why things are as they are, so they can figure out what they can change, figure out what they shouldn't try to change, and the wisdom to know the difference between the two. This goes back to the point that we certainly aren't suggesting that we live in the best of all possible worlds where no organizational improvements can be made. But before you go about changing things willy-nilly, it's really important to understand why things are the way they are first.
Well, there's something I certainly wouldn't have changed, which is who I chose to be my guest on this Sunday's Work with Marty Nemco. I want to thank you both. Ray Fisman and Tim Sullivan, you were great. There's a little smile on my face. When I have a really good guest, I have this little smile. I'm wearing that smile at this moment. The book is The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office. It is a fun read, even if you don't give a crap about organizations. There are lots of great stories, but if you do have some interest in organizations, it will be a balm. It will make you feel better about understanding the craziness, the apparent craziness that exists. Anyway, I commend it to you, and I commend you both, Ray and Tim. Take care, and thanks for giving me part of your Sunday.
Hey, thanks a lot, Marty. It was a lot of fun.
Great.
Yeah, thank you.
Right, bye.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, dear listeners, it's now your time. If you have a question, we were not, for technical reasons, because we had two guests, we weren't able to take calls while they were on the line. I otherwise would have been happy to let you ask them questions. But in any case, you're stuck with me. If you have a question for me about your life in your organization, you know, you're struggling, you hate your boss, you hate your coworkers, or you simply have any kind of a career-related problem, unemployed, not well enough employed, highly successful and still feeling anomie, angst, not knowing what's next for you, for a three-minute career makeover is what I call it, a three-minute work. I like workover better. I kind of like the pun. Anyway, the number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I already call us on the line. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind? Hello, it's you.
Hi, my name's Betty.
Hi, Betty.
Hi. I wanted advice on how to help my partner. He has ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
He's been laid off. He's mostly worked in education, mm-hmm. community outreach,
mm-hmm.
looking for a job. And he's really kind of doesn't have a lot of confidence about what to do to look for a job, and it's been really hard finding one.
Okay. People with ADHD can do a whole lot better using one or more of the following things. So let's start with that, since that's what you led with. You know, if really he is either he's working at home where he can control his environment, or he puts up little cardboard walls on his carrel and he faces instead of the group, the room, he's facing the wall. Has he done enough to control the extra stimulation in his environment?
You mean at home?
At work, you know, in his workplace. Because I want to give him reason for...
Right now, but in the past, no.
Yeah, I want to give him reason for hope that the next time around, he won't be unsuccessful. And so that's, you know, one thing that would give him a little bit more encouragement that, okay, maybe I got laid off because my ADHD, I was distractible, I made too many errors, whatever. But, you know, these are some pretty simple things that I can do to ensure that I am less distractible. Also, he certainly, people who are of ADHD do best when they have highly structured tasks, when they're not asked to multitask and react on the spot, but they have one thing to do. Is he a person like that?
That's true, but the bigger question is, what kind of job should he go for? He's not able to succeed in securing a job.
Okay, so let's go there now. So tell me some clues about who he is, and I'm going to start, we'll play a couple of games to try to figure out what might be an appropriate next avenue for him.
Okay.
So tell me two or three little nuggets about who, his skills, his interests, his, you know, that stuff.
Okay, he's great at writing, mm-hmm. creative writing.
Okay.
He can do nonfiction, too. His biggest skill within the writing realm is writing humorously.
Okay. Tell me more. What's some another element of who he is?
Really into sports, loves watching all sports, mm-hmm. has played a lot, still plays lots of tennis.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a little bit of coaching.
Mm. How did he do as a coach?
Sometimes it can be make him a little bit anxious.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's normal. Is it the normal anxiety that any coach has, or is it different than that?
It's a little bit more than normal. That's the key.
Let's go off that. Okay, so we've got the writing, we've got the sports. Give me one more nugget, and then we're going to start playing our little games here.
Teaching. Doesn't like teaching that much.
No, let's drop that. Something that is not a struggle for him, because he's got enough struggle going on with the ADHD. We want the rest of the picture to be something that comes easy and natural. So writing and sports are easy and natural. What else is easy and natural for him?
He would be great at being a tour guide in, say, San Francisco, showing people around.
Okay, great. So we're just going to play here. I'm not saying he should do this. I'm just going to the most obvious amalgamation of those three things, writing, sports, and tour guides. If he were to create a plan for a sports nut tour of San Francisco or the Bay Area, would he enjoy writing that? Writing that plan, for starters, a sports nuts tour of San Francisco.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
So what if I said that may not be his job, but that's a calling card. That's going to help him get hired. If he wants to be a writer, maybe writing for the travel section of the Chronicle, maybe writing for a sports publication, something like that. If that might give him the best, that kind of project would be the best kind of work sample for him. I encourage him to write the sports, a step-by-step, like one paragraph on each stop along the way of the tour, with a little introduction that's clever and funny, and a conclusion that's clever and funny, and use that to send to various entities that exist in San Francisco, everything from the tourist board to the San Francisco Giants to every sports team to ever to the convention bureau to city government that's interested in promoting. Let him use that as his calling card. And the beauty of a writing-centric job is it is less distraction-prone because he can either do that at home or he doesn't need to do a lot of interacting with other people. He's not multitasking. What do you think?
That sounds great.
I thank you for the call, Betty.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. You know what I want to do, because there's only a couple of minutes here of time, I want to just give you a couple of tips that are that don't lead to calls, that don't require a call. I wrote for AOL, for U.S. News, a piece that got republished by Yahoo last week, and it's called 10 Life Lessons That Are Guaranteed to Advance Your Career. And I want to share a couple of those with you. First one makes me a little nervous because it's a little pontificating. I wrote, don't sell out for stuff. Shopaholism requires you to make lots of money, and most employers who pay employees lots of money do so because the work is difficult, distasteful, spiritually empty, or it requires absurdly long work hours. That's a very high price to pay for designer labels or for a fancy address or a fancy nameplate on your car. If instead you find your contentment in productivity, in creative outlets, and in relationships, as opposed to buying stuff, you won't need to pursue such a financially remunerative career. Instead, you could pursue a career you'd find more fun, like one in a startup, or in a creative field, or work for a cause you believe in. So that's tip one, don't sell out for stuff. Next one, and this is something I really find useful for so many of my clients who are not driven intrinsically. The phrase I like to use is make it fun. There is usually a more fun or a less fun way to get everything done, each item done. If you do your tasks the most arduous way, the benefit of it being so perfect is usually outweighed by your tendency to procrastinate the task and overall just being less content with your work life. So, especially if you're kind of a fun-seeking person, more hedonistic than Calvinistic, as you decide what you want to do and how you want to do it, keep asking yourself, what's the fun way? Usually you're going to find the work gets done faster and maybe even often better. Third tip, I've got time for one more. Be a storyteller. Most people are more affected by story than by statistics. Story appeals to the emotion. And emotion is what motivates most people to change their behavior. That's why so many articles that you read start with Mary Johnson, blah, 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 and you tell the story of Mary Johnson. And only after your audience is hooked do they mention statistics and facts. So have three anecdotes ready at any time to tell, whether you're at a networking meeting, whether you're even for a water cooler conversation. And if you're looking for a job, having those stories, anecdotes that demonstrate your skills are critical. Certainly, and if you're giving a talk, pepper your talks with an anecdote, whether it's a two-minute presentation in a meeting, whether you're giving a keynote address, or even a toast at your friend's wedding. And I guess what nicer way to end the show than talking about a toast at somebody's wedding. Anyway, that's Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, for all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. And you ever feel guilty at work? For example, you feel you're not as good at your job as you should be, or maybe you should be contributing more to your family's income? Guilt. That's work's unspoken emotion. I'll invite you to call in and tell your tale. You tell me yours, I'll tell you mine. Plus, you can call in for a 3-minute workover, as I said. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.